Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. One of the most influential books in history turns 400 this year, and it's never been out of print. The King James Bible, circa 1611, was a grand creation, translation, literary effort, political tool that stuck for centuries. Its majestic text has shaped language, culture, politics, and religion. Like it or not, know it or not, if you speak English, you speak King James. A drop in the bucket, feet of clay, fly in the ointment, tender mercies, it's all there. So did Abraham Lincoln speak that language, and Martin Luther King, Norman Mailer, Bob Dylan. This hour On Point, 400 years of the King James Bible and its impact on our lives. You can join the conversation. Did you grow up with it, the these and thous? Whether you did or not, do you recognize its impact? Do you have a favorite passage? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Leicester, England, is Gordon Campbell, Professor of Renaissance Studies at the University of Leicester. He wrote the afterword to the Oxford University Press's 400th year anniversary edition of the King James Bible. He is author of Bible, the Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011. Professor Campbell, thank you very much for being with us.
It's good to be with you today.
Why did King James order up this Bible, sir?
Well, he had arrived from Scotland in 1603, and he was regarded in England as a foreigner. And yet one of his jobs as king was to be head of the Church of England. And in order to legitimate that role as head of the Church of England, he needed ideally an English Bible that was dedicated to him. And that was the impulse, the political impulse, if you like, that lay behind this new translation.
Who put it together for him? I mean, what a massive undertaking. How was it actually accomplished?
He called a conference at Hampton Court, his palace to the west of London, and assembled the bishops and some Puritans, and together and in the weeks thereafter, they drew up a list of rules that all the translators were to obey. And there were then some 50 translators appointed, organized into six committees, two in Oxford, two in Cambridge, and two in Westminster, in London, as it were.
And how much was pulled from the original languages in which the Bible emerged, and how much was pulled from extant English versions of the Bible?
It was officially a revision of the Bishop's Bible, which was a translation that had been done by bishops about half a century before. So the translators were instructed to the effect that that was the base text, but they were to take into account all other earlier English translations, and they were also to refer to the Greek and the Hebrew and the Aramaic and the Samaritan and the Ge'ez, and all those other learned languages came into the argument. And at the revision stage, they were also obliged to compare their draft translation with Protestant Bibles in French and Italian and Spanish and German. So many languages came into the final product.
This was quite a group of scholars. What about the impulses within this Bible? We hear a lot about the Bible version by William Tyndale behind this one. From nearly a century earlier, he who said he wanted to have a Bible that could be read by the boy who drives the plow, I guess every man. On the other hand, we think of the King James Version as, you know, quite ornate, antique, majestic even. How do those two threads work together here, Gordon Campbell?
Well, the translators took Tyndale's view on board, and indeed many of them took the even more radical view that not only should ploughboys be able to understand the Bible, but women should as well. Indeed, there were some bishops who were a little uneasy about this. They were an extremely learned group, and indeed their meetings took place in Latin, but the object of their endeavors was to produce a Bible that was characterized by simplicity and accessibility. So one of the ways ways they did that, for example, was trying to eliminate as many words with more than one syllable as they possibly could. So in, say, the beginning of Psalm 23, in the Bishop's Bible that they were revising, it said, God is my shepherd, therefore I will lack nothing. Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly understandable,
yes.
But it was changed to, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And that did two things. One was that it knocked out two of the polysyllabic words. And the second is it gave it a kind of pulse. So it became, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And that made it easier to read aloud, and it made it easier to memorize.
It's a powerful pulse, a powerful cadence. I mean, a cadence that, to my ear, seems to have flown with almost tyrannical vigor through the English language ever since.
Indeed. Well, it was also imitating the English language of the time. The poetic form closest to spoken English is iambic pentameter, mm-hmm. which is the meter that Shakespeare used. So if you take a bit like the beginning of Genesis 3, when the god of the garden of Eden carpets Adam and Eve because they've disobeyed him, mm-hmm. and Adam rather ungallantly decides to blame Eve,
yes.
and says, she gave me of the tree and I did eat. Now that's a perfect iambic pentameter line.
Yes.
Ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare could have written it, and as it happens, Milton simply picked it up and dropped it into Paradise Lost. So this is a language that, while in Hebrew and Greek, it's prose, in the translation that the King James translators prepared, it effectively is like a prose poem. It has a pulse of speech as it is delivered rather than written.
Well, what about Milton and Shakespeare and so many other writers who have come later? I mean, people hear King James, you know, in Toni Morrison, even Bob Dylan. What about the way it's come down? Go back to Milton and Shakespeare. Would they have felt influenced by this Bible, or were they just sharing the same sort of, you know, cultured sense of the inner music of the English language? You know, who was teaching whom here?
That's a very good question. In the case of Milton, he was one of these learned chaps who used a Protestant Latin Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But the evidence that he used the King James Version is twofold. One is that line that I just quoted, but the second is that his family Bible, in which he inscribed the births and marriages and deaths in his family, was a King James Bible from 1617. So he clearly used it. In the case of Shakespeare, the dates aren't quite right, in that the second half of Shakespeare's career was exactly the same time
right.
as the Bible was being done, and that led in the early 20th century to the wonderful lunacy, to the effect that Shakespeare was one of the revisers. Do you know the
he actually wrote it?
indeed.
Would have it.
Well, the proof for this is Psalm 46, because
yes.
if you look at the 46th word, it's shake, and the 46th word from the end is spear. Shakespeare was 46 in 2010.
Say my name.
That's right, absolutely. And if you look at the letters in the middle, they form some kind of bizarre acrostic that says, I am William. So it's the old adage that if there is no evidence, you manufacture some.
You know, when you look at all the figures of speech and phrases that we use so commonly today that you can find in the pages of the King James Bible, and I mean, they are legion, I think, is the right word here. Let me just rattle some of them off. You know, at the wit's end, baptism of fire, bite the dust, broken heart, by the skin of your teeth, by the sweat of your brow, can a leopard change its spots, cast the first stone, cross to bear, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, fall by the wayside, fall from grace, fat of the land. It goes right on. Were these created by the creators of the King James Bible, and that we've absorbed them ever since as critical phrases in the English language, or were they picking up vernacular colloquialisms from English of their time and you know, using them in this Bible?
Well, and there's a third possibility, which is that they are recycling phrases from earlier Bibles.
Yes.
And all three of those are the case. The translators, even when they borrowed, often borrowed things that reflected current London English. And many of these phrases do that. Some of them reflect an attempt to translate particularly the Hebrew literally, fall flat on your face, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they are a combination combination of, if you like, street language, but also language that reflects a scholarly sense of what it means. And in many cases, the words have stuck through all sorts of subsequent translations. Even Robert Alter's translation, for example, which is wonderful, of Genesis in the Jewish tradition. And he decided, when confronted with "Am I my brother's keeper?", it had such power over him, and there's nothing wrong with it, it's perfectly accurate, that it sort of stayed in, as it were. So the phrases come from all sorts of roots, but the important thing is that the King James Bible is the conduit for all of these phrases. We don't, I think, recognize the biblical origins anymore of, you know, "How are the mighty fallen, and fly in the ointment, and go the second mile." And I suppose that's just part of the secularization of our society.
Gordon Campbell, stand by if you'd be so kind. There in Leicester, England, it's great to have you with us. Author of "Bible, the Story of the King James Version." In a moment, Margaret Mitchell joins us, Dean of the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. A little music here from 1611. You remember this hot release. We're talking about the King James Bible at 400. Listeners, you can join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the King James Bible at 400, the glorious, majestic 1611 version that was the Bible for centuries, looking at its colorful history, its language, its impact. Believers, unbelievers, you name it, this version of the Bible sits behind the English language and a lot of Western culture in a very potent way. Four centuries speak to that. Gordon Campbell is with us from Leicester, England, professor of Renaissance studies there at the University of Leicester, author of "Bible, the Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2001. Lots of response online to this. Here's Marlon on Facebook says, "My grandmother would always quote Proverbs 3, 5 to 6. Every time I read the words, I can hear the sweet serenity and faith in her voice. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lead not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths." The King James Version directing the paths of our language, whether or not we like it or know it, very often these days. With us right now from Chicago is Margaret Mitchell, Dean of the Divinity School at the University of Chicago, professor of New Testament and Early Christian Literature, author of "Paul, the Corinthians, and the Birth of Christian Hermeneutics," co-editor of the Cambridge History of Christianity, Volume 1. Dean Mitchell, Margaret Mitchell, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to join you, Tom.
How do you think about the King James Bible in theological terms, in the sweep of the history of the faith that it represents? What did it represent in its version, in its presentation of this religion?
Well, there's no doubt that the King James Bible was an attempt to unify a splintering Christian faithful under King James, and every attempt to unify multiple communities in a single Bible has its problems. It did indeed command the field for a very long time, and still today there are some for whom it is the only Bible. But in fact, the Bible is not a fixed document, and it has changed over time, and multiple translations are still available. There are different ways in which one can judge the validity and the importance of any translation: its fidelity to the original, its authority ecclesiastically, its beauty in English style, etc. No doubt on beauty in English style, the King James has got it. But in terms of its fidelity to our best ability to reconstruct the Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic texts underlying it, there are In fact, there are more literal and closer translations now available.
What about its usage in the United States? We'll ask Gordon Campbell about earlier still in England, but in this country, you know, what was the era of its, I don't know what the right word is, hegemony in churches? And was it all churches or mainly Protestant churches? You know, how widespread was its hold in the pew itself? And when did that, I have a feeling that that has diminished. I grew up with it, but even in my youth, people were turning away from it to more colloquial English versions of the Bible.
Well, there's no doubt that from the 17th century forward, it was a standard Bible, and it still is, especially in Baptist and other churches, which hold on with great fervor to the King James as the Bible, which must be read and obeyed. But it is the case that, of course, the King James itself, and perhaps Gordon will talk about this, that the King James Bible itself has undergone revisions over time. So it's not just counter readings to the King James, but it's the King James itself as a living text.
Gordon Campbell, what about the King himself and what he wanted out of this? There were other Bibles in usage when he ordered this one up that that contained very outright challenges to monarchy, as I understand it. And part of what he was doing here was trying to counter that.
Well, indeed, and because of that, he insisted in the instructions to the translators that there be no marginal annotations of any kind. That left a challenge to the translators, of course, in that they wanted to have a Christian reading of the Old Testament, and that had traditionally been done through the mechanism of marginal notes, and they weren't allowed to do that, so they had to find other ways of getting around it. But he wanted a Bible that would essentially support him as head of the church.
No marginal annotations because, what, earlier, was it Puritan versions, had been sort of down with the king in the margins of the Bible?
Well, the Geneva Bible, which had been done by English and Scottish exiles on the continent in Germany and then in Geneva. If you take, for example, the story of the Pharaoh and the midwives at the beginning of Exodus, the Pharaoh had ordered the midwives to kill all the male Jewish babies. Mm-hmm. They failed to do so, and the marginal note in the Geneva Bible said that the disobedience of the midwives was lawful. And James thought that was outrageous. He thought it's never legitimate to disobey a king under any circumstances and whatever the consequences.
Oh, wow.
So he wanted a Bible without any kind of annotation like that. And that's what he got.
What was the decision to take the annotation out of the Old Testament? Did it leave the King James Bible in a sense, more respectful of the Jewish scripture that Old Testament comes to us from, the Torah, or not?
They found other ways around it. I mean, partly in their lexical choices, they decided to say, "I know that my Redeemer liveth," and Redeemer, I mean, the word in Hebrew means it's closer to defense attorney. It's nothing about redemption. Mm. Or in Psalm 28, where it says they pierced my hands and my feet. Now the verb is talking about what a lion does to you, and a lion might, I don't know, maul you or bite your hands. It wouldn't pierce you. But they chose pierce because they believed the passage anticipated the crucifixion of Jesus in the New Testament. So there are loads and loads of examples of the way of imposing a reading that indeed was not sympathetic to Jewish readings, though it was informed by Jewish readings on technical issues like place names. Mm.
Gordon Campbell, Margaret Mitchell, stand by. We have many listeners calling in to join us, and I want to begin to turn to them. Chesapeake, Virginia, David is calling. Hi, David. Great to have you. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, with all of the different translations and King James, you know, since 1611, ordering, you know, his version of I guess, the Bible and it having been written by bishops and there's a possibility that, you know, even Shakespeare may have had some influence with that.
I think Gordon Campbell is sort of discounting that, but it is interesting to note that they're sort of a contemporaries.
Right. Well, what I mean by that is that maybe he didn't have direct influence, but during those times, the powerfulness of their literary works and plays and so forth, you know, have a direct bearing on how people think and feel and tend to write.
Sure.
And even translate or define certain words. So, mm-hmm. you know, with all of that, how, you know, and since, you know, within the U.S., I mean, there's so many Christian religions that, you know, and people across the world who base their entire faith on the King James, you know, version mm-hmm. of the Bible, how accurate is it, you know, is the Bible of the King James Version, how accurate is it really since, you know, the original scriptures were put out to begin with?
David, let us pick it up. Margaret Mitchell, you've mentioned this, but there, I mean, there's the great big giant question. The accuracy is some concept in itself when it comes to the Bible, but how do you respond to David?
Well, let me just say that accuracy can be measured on several different grounds. One of the first and sort of most significant ones is how good were in particular the Greek manuscripts upon which the King James translators drew in their translation of the 27 documents of the New Testament. With the rise of modern textual criticism in the 18th and 19th centuries, it was determined that those manuscripts were not as good as three major manuscripts from the 4th and 5th centuries, Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, and Alexandrinus, and hence they, for example, do not have what is now Mark 16, 9 through 20 secondary endings to the Gospel of Mark. So it looks as though those were later added. There are verses, if you look in a new RSV, for example.
Revised Standard Version of the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right, the New Revised Standard Version, that if you go to Mark 11:26, there's no verse there. And the reason it's not there is because the later, the earlier manuscripts that we have don't have that verse, but the versification came in with the modern printed Bibles, for example. So that's one issue is text. The other is in terms of translation and accuracy. I mean, in many ways, I mean, this is a remarkable work of scholarship, the King James Version, and everyone still needs to consult it because it's a part of the history of engagement with the text. But it is not in every item and every moment fully accurate. But the other issue is, how has English changed? That is, how has the receptor language English changed such that the King James now does not sound and mean what we mean by, I will take no bull from your house, for example.
I'm either going to take a bovine or take no guff? Is that what you mean?
Well, in the original context, what that has to do with is the denial of the efficacy of the sacrificial cult if there isn't a pious demeanor behind it.
Gordon Campbell, that is interesting. Do we still read the King James Version of the Bible, its English, in a way that you find generally true to its meaning? I mean, it's a little thick sometimes with the ornate phrasing, but to the extent that we read and perceive it, do we get it right these days?
I think there is a problem. The language has moved on in the course of 400 years, and rightly so. But much of the King James Bible is perfectly easy to understand. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.
Yep.
It's not exactly complex,
no,
is it?
No, it's not. I
think Margaret is right to say there is a real problem with new Greek manuscripts. So the King James Bible they were remarkably good, both Hellenists and Hebraists.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a question about the text that they were translating with respect to the New Testament. And there's one particularly important verse, which scholars know as the Johannine comma. It's 1 John 5:7, and it's the gist of it is that there's the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and these three are one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was put into the King James Bible after much debate, because they were uncertain about its legitimacy. But it is, of course, a key proof text for the doctrine of the Trinity. And modern Bibles, many modern Bibles, simply leave it out on the grounds that it's a medieval forgery. So these are not simply dry textual matters, not that there's anything wrong with dry textual matters, but they also impinge on doctrinal issues of which the Trinity is an important one. And the King James Bible backs the Trinity, rightly or wrongly.
Wow, I guess that's pretty much at the heart of many people's understanding of the religion. Ben in Lexington, Kentucky. Ben, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. You know, it's interesting, actually coming on, waiting to speak with you all, listening to the talk about the accuracy of the scriptures and the Johannine comma especially. This is very interesting to me. I'm an Orthodox Christian.
Okay.
So we're not directly related to the Protestants. We broke away there was a schism between the Roman Catholics and my church about 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, that's a ways.
So there's no direct connection there really to the Protestant church except to the Catholic church. And so we're not sola scripturist, you know, scripture alone, which was doctrine from the Reformation. And so it's interesting to hear the talk of textual criticism and accuracy, and you know, was this added later and this here, and where did this come from, and can we trust this, and all the different manuscripts that have been found and studied even after that translation, to look back and say, well, did they really translate this accurately? Now we found more with modern archaeology and things. And for us, it's really interesting because we use the King James, and we use King James-style English a lot of times in our liturgies and in our daily cycle services. You can walk into an Orthodox church in the U.S. or in England and hear the these and the thous and the yees and these things. And for us, it's not just the accuracy and how close is it, but there's also a majesty and a beauty to the faith, and that's really important to us, and further even the idea of tradition is kind of absent more so from Protestant churches than it is for us.
Hey, Ben, do you hear that majesty bleeding right out of churches and pew land and into our secular language? Do you hear it there in our literature, Ben?
I think so. I do lament a bit that that has been lost somewhat. I personally love it. I love going to church and hearing those things. But I think to argue that those things haven't influenced us and still exist today, absolutely they do.
Ben, I appreciate your call. I mean, Margaret Mitchell, you know, again, for whether listeners are Christian or not, embrace it wholeheartedly or wholly, you know, go in another direction. I'm reading Boyd Tonkin here, had a terrific piece in Arts and Book Review, just looking at all the literary figures whose work breathes with this King James kind of feel. I mean, never mind Abraham Lincoln or Martin Luther King, his I Have a Dream speech, right out practically of Isaiah, but Herman Melville and Walt Whitman, Ernest Hemingway, Allen Ginsberg, you know, or very contemporary, Toni Morrison, Cormac McCarthy, Bob Dylan is singing in his songs. This cadence, this texture is all around us, Margaret.
Well, it's absolutely true, and there is a feel, as the caller put it, of majesty, beauty, and tradition, and yet at the same time, there's a question of whether the Bible is its own diction, utterly archaic and utterly apart from living communities, either of faith or of culture. And so, one of the questions that we could ask ourselves and listeners is, who says you have to only have one Bible? Why not multiple Bibles for multiple purposes?
And I guess these days that is very, very much the case. You can find multiple Bibles in the pews of a single church, multiple different versions.
Right. That's absolutely so. Now, one of the issues that's interesting here, though, is that there is a kind of ironic relationship here to what the earliest Greek fathers, because our caller was coming out of the Greek Orthodox mm-hmm. tradition, our earliest Greek patristic authors were actually trying to elevate the language of the New Testament to a literary classic, because they had to recognize that it didn't have quite the prosaic style of Demosthenes or Plato or others. And so they, in fact, wanted to argue that the simple diction of the Bible was a proof that it was inspired and that it was available to everyone, whereas the Platonic dialogues were, for example, for a particular elite. So creating
really
a literary standard goes back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the King James Bible at 400. King James, ordered it up in 1604, 1611. There it was, and for most of those following 400 years, it really dominated in churches very much around the world. As the British Empire grew, the King James Bible went with it. Glorious, majestic language. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but its power in the faith and in culture and language generally undeniable. Gordon Campbell joins us this hour, professor of Renaissance Studies at the University of Leicester from Leicester, England. And Margaret Mitchell is with us, dean of the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. And I mean, the list of phrases from this version of the Bible just goes on and on, right deep in our language. How the mighty have fallen, labor of love, in the twinkling of an eye, lamb to the slaughter, letter of the law, manna from heaven, my cup runneth over, nothing new under the sun, no rest for the wicked, sign of the times, sour grapes, tender mercies, and right on down. It's kind of an unbelievable litany of phrases that we still use every day. Here's from Sophia online. She writes, the beauty of the language in this version cannot be denied. She says, you asked for a favorite passage, Tom. She points to Ecclesiastes 3, 1 to 8, you know, made famous now from the way it's used at weddings, she writes. To everything there's a season, and to every purpose under the heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up, to weep, to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance. There is a poetry there. Susan in Chesapeake, Virginia, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and I attended a Sunday school at the Baptist Church every Sunday. And every year my father would read the first Christmas out of the Bible, out of St. Luke. I know it by heart to this day. Mm-hmm. When I graduated from 6th to 7th grade, I was presented my own copy of King James. And it's, to me, it's poetry. It's the ultimate poetic work. The text is so melodic, and to me, poetry is melody. And any other version that has gone, been translated to just regular, everyday language, it's lost. It's musicality, and I think King James speaks to the soul.
Susan, I love your call, and I relate wholly to it. I mean, I must say, for me personally, there are also times I felt a prisoner of that cadence. It was hard to write anything that didn't have it, that felt right after that kind of relationship with it. But Margaret Mitchell, I want to put it to you as a theologian. That musicality, that poetry, it can be absolutely captivating. But how do you look at that aspect of it? Is that, you know, is that the wonder of religion? Is that a kind of hypnosis? What is that exactly? How do you look at it as a theologian, that artistry?
Well, let me tie back to an earlier point about style and how one knows when you're in the Bible, right? How does the Bible sound? And it's probably important to note that the authors of the New Testament themselves kind of knew what the Bible sounded like. And for them, it was the Bible, the scriptures of Israel as known in Greek. So in Luke, after Luke writes a very nice Hellenistic preface to his work, he then says, and in the days when Herod the king, and he's doing that kind of sing-song of this is what the Bible sounds like. Mm-hmm. Now, to the degree that the Bible then creates its own sort of cultural meaning and sensibility, for many people that's extremely powerful, and I don't deny that in the least. But at the same time, I think for some it can be antiquating, right? So that the biblical text is always a text of another day. And in this case, this is a text, the King James is a text of the 17th century, and hence it is antiquarian, but it's not antiquarian in that it goes back to the first century or the first millennium. It fixes a particular moment in time in the history of the English language.
You've got all kinds of responses here these days, of course, because you have all kinds of responses to religion, never mind the language. Lee says, throw that book out, Babylonian, Draconian garbage. Greg says, perhaps you'd like to throw out Western culture as well. And Gordon Campbell, Greg also writes, what this version does show is the extraordinary culture that existed in England at that time. What more could an age claim for itself than having Shakespeare and Marlowe and others at the same time these translators and editors lived? I mean, just for erudition and poetry, it's a remarkable accomplishment, Gordon. It is a signpost of some kind of high mark in cultural terms.
Oh, indeed, indeed. And it's often respected for that to a point where some people start to cry idolatry. Yeah. It is the greatest work of English prose. It seems to me if you think of similarities to that culture, though, you have to look to cultures in which there's a strong oral component. I'm thinking, for example, one of the great groups that use the King James Bible now are African-American churches. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is that there is still in that tradition a powerful kind of preaching that lives on into the 21st century. And the oral skills, if you like, that go into the preaching that you hear in any African-American church on a Sunday relate quite directly to the kinds of sermons that you were hearing in 1611, when the Bible most often entered people's lives not through their eyes. They weren't reading. They were listening to it. The Word of God was going into their ears. So that kind of tradition of listening to the Bible still lives on in ways that actually resemble the oral culture of 1611.
Where do you look for, I don't know, a passage from the King James Version of the Bible that seems perhaps archetypically King Jamesian, Gordon? I mean, it's all through. You can't read a line without kind of knowing where you are in terms of the Bible's lineage. But I don't know, what passage, what verse?
I think what I admire in particular is in the Old Testament, I'm thinking of, is the ability to imitate Greek or Hebrew structures like parallelism. So if you take a passage like Ruth's plea to Naomi at the beginning of Ruth, entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee, for whither thou goest I will go, and where thou lodgest I will lodge. Mm. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. It's just so wonderfully constructed, and the cadences of it's also beautifully clear, and the cadences of it carry you along, and it is astonishingly faithful to these parallel structures in the Hebrew behind it. At moments like that, when I read it, I'm tempted to applaud. I think they were so good at what they were doing.
It, practically irresistible. Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. And pretty soon, we're marrying up right and left. Dustin in Idaho Falls, Idaho. Dustin, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I am LDS or Mormon, and so I'll be the first to admit that we have a very different take on the Bible.
Uh-huh.
But we still use the King James Bible as our mainstay. That's our choice scripture.
Now, that's interesting. Why do you think Mormons have stuck with this when some other denominations and faiths have moved to others, Dustin?
Well, even the founder, Joseph Smith, he openly criticized the translation of the King James Bible and started seeing if we could translate it better. But the way that I've come to understand it is it's the translation we have that we started with, and that if we further try to, you know, translate it or anything, that our modern interpretations can start bending it a little bit. Just because whenever you're translating anything, you can start putting your own words into it, just like was put into the King James Bible.
But that's interesting for a Mormon to say. First of all, given that Mormons have certainly brought their own spin on the faith to life, and we're hearing today, Dustin. I mean, of course, it was new itself in 1611 in some sense. Every time we translate, we're bending one way or another, aren't we?
Yes, we are. And the big thing about Mormons is we believe in personal revelation. We believe that you can gain your own understanding. You don't have to have a scripture as your
path, maybe?
As your end all.
Right.
And so as we decided as a church just to, keep the King James Bible as it is, we have tons of scholars that go back and, I go to school at BYU and that, endlessly read Hebrew and Greek documents and talk to us about what their scriptures were really trying to say. But what it really comes down to is just getting your own understanding, praying about it, reading the words, how it means to you, and your relationship between you and God.
And you have the music and the majesty of it there in the King James Version. Dustin, thanks for your call. Deanna in Ridgeland, South Carolina. Deanna, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a concern with using the King James Bible because the Torah, the first five books of the Bible,
yes,
set the stage for the rest of the whole work, as I understand it. I'm wondering why these English scholars changed the names of these Jewish Hebrew people into nice English names, such as her name was Hawa. They changed it to Eve. His name was Isaiah. Well, his real name was Yeshayahu. They changed it from Yeshua into Jesus. And they made God's name a generic name. Any heathen that believed in any God could say many of the scriptures for themselves, whereas if they had translated it authentically, which would have been Yud-Heh-Vov-Heh or Yahweh, they made it God.
So, Deanna, let me ask you, beyond the mere translation or cultural familiarization of that, does it create a problem? Does it create a divide that maybe there didn't need to be one? Is that what you're pushing at?
Right. I'm wondering why they made these Hebrew people into English people, why they changed the word Torah, meaning the first five books of the Bible, into a word like law. I think people are so confused about it. Would mean so much more if it said Torah.
Gordon Campbell, let us pick it up. And I appreciate your call, Deanna. What about the anglicizing of what was there from the beginning? Did that begin with King James, or?
It didn't, but Deanna's point is absolutely right, I must say. It is anglicized. It's also Hellenized. I mean, the first book of the Bible is called Genesis, and that's a Greek word for beginning. It's not a Hebrew word. But certainly the translators agonized over this question of names. They worried about whether a name in Hebrew should be translated the same way as a similar name in Greek. But in the end, what the rules they were given said that it wasn't a case of trying to replicate the Hebrew names. It was a case of trying to bring them into English. So it's absolutely right that there was no attempt to honor either the Hebrew tradition of the names or indeed traditional Jewish understandings of what those names meant. So the point is very well made by your listener.
On the other hand, Margaret Mitchell, I mean, in some sense, there's an ultimate kind of honoring going on here, and building a whole faith that saw itself as new on these ancient books that Deanna points to. What do you make of the Anglicization? Is this English imperialism moving in on ancient scripture?
Well, I think Gordon is right that this goes all the way back into the early church in terms of they're reading the scriptures in the Septuagint and then into the Vulgate and the transformation of names. I mean, and there are some very interesting things like Joshua, son of Nun, Yehoshua ben Nun in the Hebrew scriptures. His name is Jesus in the Septuagint. And this offered up all kinds of interesting possibilities for early Christian exegetes. One other example is the figure who is referred to as James, and there are multiple Jameses in the New Testament, but James, the brother of the Lord, is Jacobus. He's Jacob, and he comes out to be James really through, I think, the Old Latin, which changes Jacobus to Jacomus and then into James, into English. And so we, in our Bibles, have a James and Jacob as two different names, but this is a matter of the tradition of the transliteration and of that name.
You know, with the King James Bible at its 400th anniversary now, you do have to ask, since it's in many churches it's fallen out of usage, and many people have fallen out of churches. We had one of our listeners saying online, if you reject this, you're rejecting Western culture. The Bible may have been made, to some taste, overly musical and poetic in this rendering, Margaret Mitchell, but that gave it a kind of a cultural power that as people move away from King James and maybe away from churches and Bible, there's continents of culture that drift away with them. What about simple biblical awareness today in what seems to me maybe the post-King James era?
Well, I certainly would never say that the King James is overly musical. I think it's utterly powerful, and it's a great work of world and English literature. Biblical literacy has always been an issue. People were decrying that in the early church. John Chrysostom would say, "You can all say who the horses are who are running in the racetrack, but you can't name the cities to which Paul wrote letters." He says that in the fourth century. I'm not sure that that's only a matter of translation, though it's possible that for some the King James seems dated and therefore less of interest. There are, in fact, Bible zines right now that, like Revolve, that put the whole New Testament in what looks like a 17 magazine in order to try to entice interest among adolescents. I'm not quite sure how successful those are. But those are kind of marketing moves to try to make the Bible of interest.
Gordon Campbell, the Bible, I guess, isn't going away. I'm just reading a story here today saying that Mark Burnett, the guy who made the American television show Survivor and The Apprentice and Sarah Palin's Alaska, is now going to do a 10-part scripted drama for the History Channel of the Bible. But the King James Version itself does seem to be at 400, moving a bit off center stage. How do you anticipate the impact of that, Gordon?
Well, I can't say that it worries me, although it remains important to certain churches. For most people, it's used rather like best china. You bring it out on special occasions. If you're inaugurating a president or if you're crowning a king, then out comes the King James Bible. And part of the reason is the beauty of the language, but the other part is that it's meant to be read aloud. And that's what keeps it central to our tradition. It will outlast many competitors.
I guess it is in a way spoken aloud almost every time we open our mouths with all the phrases we still use from it these days. It's been wonderful to look on the 400th anniversary of the creation of this version with the two of you today. Gordon Campbell, author of Bible, The Story of the King James Version, 1611, 2011, joining us from Leicester, England. Thank you so much for your time and thoughts today.
Good to be with you.
And Margaret Mitchell, Dean of the Divinity School, University of Chicago. Margaret, thanks for being with us. Great to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.